This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Here's what Wikipedia has to say about eugenics. Eugenics is the applied science or the biosocial movement advocating the use of practices aimed at improving the genetic composition of a population, usually referring to human populations. It was widely popular in the early decades of the 20th century, but by mid-century, eugenics had fallen into disfavor, having become associated with Nazi Germany. North Carolina practiced a form of eugenics from the 1920s into the 70s through a state-sanctioned program of sterilization practiced on some 7,600 men, women, and children, some as young as 10. Worse, even as other states stopped such practices, we ramped ours up before finally ending it. Most of the victims were poor, undereducated, institutionalized, sick, or disabled, and all fell under the authority of the North Carolina Eugenics Board. And now, there is a proposal to offer justice to the victims in the form of monetary compensation. And that's what we're going to spend this hour talking about. Charmaine Fuller Cooper is the executive director of the North Carolina Justice for Sterilization Victims Foundation, a division of the North Carolina Department of Administration. She joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Welcome to the program. Paul Lombardo is a professor of law at Georgia State University with an expertise in the history of state-sanctioned eugenic sterilization, science, and law, and the author of A Century of Eugenics in America, From the Indiana Experiment to the Human Genome Era. He joins us by phone. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
And in our studio is WFAE's Julie Rose, who has extensively reported on the reparations debate as it has unfolded, and she'll fill us in on a lot of the details of that debate. Thank you for being here as well.
You're welcome, Mike.
And we hope to be joined by Leela Dunstan, who is one of the victims of all of this later on in the program. I want to begin with a short historical perspective on this whole concept of eugenics. Dr. Lombardo, how, why, when did all of this start, and why did people think it was a good idea?
The ideas that became the eugenics movement in America are not particularly new. People had thought about breeding plants and animals for really thousands of years. And beginning in about the late 19th century, people began talking earnestly about actually engineering society using the tools of the new tools then of understanding heredity. As the 20th century turned, there was a word to use. Francis Galton, a man in England who had done a lot of science, came up with a word called eugenics, which is a Greek term meaning to be well-born. And he suggested that society should pay attention to the quality of people who were born. His ideas became popular not only in England and in Europe, but also in America in the first decade of the 20th century. And people began introducing laws that would sterilize folks so that they couldn't have children. The idea was that the best, most prosperous people should have lots of children, and those who somehow failed in the competition of life should have fewer children. And so Indiana was the first state in 1907 that passed a law to sterilize people in prisons. And within a decade, there were another dozen or so states who passed similar laws, usually applying to people in institutions. Sometimes people in mental hospitals or asylums, sometimes people in homes for what we would call people who are mentally retarded, then called the feeble-minded, and often applying to people who were in almshouses or on public welfare.
Yes, people with poverty were perceived to be of some genetic inferior genetics, I guess, as were epileptics in some cases, and as were single moms or people who had anger issues or who were troublemakers. They were all viewed as being less than prime.
The idea was that these personal problems became social problems, and that such people were responsible through their own heredity and their family's heredity for the way they behaved.
Now, Charmaine, this started in Indiana in 1907, as Dr. Lombardo said. When did it come to North Carolina? Charmaine?
It did come in to North Carolina in 1907. To Indiana in 1907. It came to North Carolina officially in 1919.
Okay.
A lot of researchers have actually written that North Carolina's first sterilization law was in 1929, But there was a 1919 law that basically allowed the state to do anything it thought was necessary for the public good. And the full intent of that 1919 legislation was eugenics and was sterilization, but those terms were left out of that legislation.
Was there a political agenda behind this? I mean, all over the country where this was practiced, or did people in the general population genuinely believe that this was a good thing to do?
You know, that was during a time where we didn't have Wikipedia and Facebook and Twitter, and the Great Depression was also going on.
Right.
So I really don't know what the historical mindset was in the early 1900s and the 1920s. Hmm. As we started to get into the 1930s and 1940s in North Carolina, and the Great Depression was ending, not only in North Carolina, but throughout many of the states, and the states weren't set up with social services programs as they are now, I believe many legislators thought that there were too many people who were draining the state system. And there were also groups in North Carolina who were promoting sterilizations and eugenics within the state. And those groups that were promoting eugenics in North Carolina were very well financed, were very resourceful, had many friends in the elite population who were elected officials, and really all of their stars lined up. Many people support social justice issues, but you don't always have the friends who are elected officials and also your own financing to get your issues accomplished. And in North Carolina, we had the Human Betterment League run by Dr. Clarence Gamble, and that really helped to propel eugenics in North Carolina.
You get a national perspective on that from Paul Lombardo. Was there a political agenda behind this practice, or again,
your other guest is here.
I'm sorry, say it again.
I would certainly endorse what's already been said about what happened in North Carolina. I think more generally across the country that, like most things in history, there were a mixture of motives. There was a motive of people who thought of themselves as philanthropists and thought they were doing good by making it easier on society to not support people who they felt were somehow defective. There were others who simply didn't want to pay taxes, and they thought the idea of supporting institutions was a bad idea and they shouldn't have to do it. There were probably others who simply thought this was a logical way of managing social problems. And the promise of a kind of utopia in which we wouldn't have any disease, we wouldn't have any disability, we wouldn't have any poverty, that argument was made pretty regularly. But I think the strongest argument over the years was an economic argument. It was an argument that said some people are too expensive. The charts were actually printed and shown at county fairs saying some people are a burden and eugenics will help us do away with those people. So I would agree with Ms. Fuller Cooper that what happened in North Carolina in many ways was consonant with the general undercurrent that was going on all over the country.
There are old documents that we found from the American Eugenics Society, which listed a series of unfit human traits, and it's really shocking when you read this because it looks like a poster that you would put up at a county fair. Feeble-mindedness, epilepsy, criminality, insanity, alcoholism, pauperism. They claim run in families and are inherited in exactly the same way as color in guinea pigs. If all marriages were eugenic, we could breed out most of this unfitness in three generations. That document looks very old, but this newer document, Julie Rose, that you have come across from what, the 1950s?
This is from 1950. Yeah, it's actually a publication of the Human Betterment League. It's a brochure with lots of colorful images and so forth, or cartoons, and it basically talks about you wouldn't expect a moron, it says, to run a train or a feeble-minded woman to teach school. You wouldn't want the state to grant driver's licenses to mental defectives. And it kind of goes on and gives a bunch of examples. And then it says, yet each day, feeble-minded and the mentally defective are entrusted with the most important and far-reaching job of all, the job of parenthood. And goes on to talk about how, you know, children deserve a healthy, stable parent, and the average feeble-minded parent cannot be expected to provide good heredity, a normal home, or intelligent care, to say nothing of the many other things needed to bring children up successfully, it says here. So, and then there's this whole section where it talks about These children need to be protected. These individuals, the selective sterilization is good for people who are limited because it protects them from jobs from which they are not qualified. And so, you know, they're definitely in the publications from that time period, as Charmaine was referring to the Human Betterment League, which was very well funded and had some and was based in Winston-Salem, actually. You know, selective sterilization was seen as good for the individuals, good for the children that they would not bear, and good for society in general, because no child, it says here, should be born to subnormal parents.
Charlene, did anybody in North Carolina dispute these publications as they came out and were disseminated across the state?
Yes. There were researchers and professors at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill from the psychology and social work programs at that time in the 1940s who wrote extensively to the Eugenics Board administration to say that they did not agree with how North Carolina was labeling epileptics with mental health defects. They did not agree with how North Carolina was promoting and marketing what was going on in the state. Also, the American Medical Association was very, very, very much involved in trying to stop basically vigilante justice that was being dispensed under the name of eugenics in North Carolina. And the American Medical Association wrote to North Carolina as well in the 1940s or 50s to say that we believe your program is being administered too broadly.
So if the AMA was against this, doctors had to perform these sterilizations. Why did they do it?
What happened in North Carolina was the secretary of North Carolina's Eugenics Board wrote a letter to all the physicians in the state saying that we can protect you. We can protect you as a state if you come through the North Carolina Eugenics Board to sterilize your victims.
Did they use the word victims?
You know, I don't really remember.
Probably not.
I'm using the word victims. But they basically said we can protect you if you sterilize your patients.
How was
through
this
the North Carolina Eugenics Board.
Okay. Dr. Lombardo, how was this handled in most states? In other words, we have this Eugenics Board here, officially sanctioned body by the state. How was it handled in the other 25 states that had sterilization laws by 1935?
Well, by 1935, as you say, we're pushing towards almost 30. The last law is passed in Georgia in 1937, and that's actually about the 31st law. So it's pretty well widespread all over the country. But North Carolina is unique in that it was a more broadly distributed program. It wasn't just focused on institutions. Take a neighboring a place like Virginia. In Virginia, you had to be at one of the state hospitals in order to be sterilized, and it was the board of the hospital that decided on that. So it was a bit harder to get a sterilization order in Virginia if they didn't find you in the community. If you weren't committed to the hospital and already a patient, then you weren't going to be sterilized. Most states work that way.
Did a person's rights vary from state to state? In other words, if you were targeted for sterilization, could you appeal? Did you have a right to appeal? Could you win that appeal?
It is the case that state laws were different in the protections that they provided, although there was a famous case in 1927 called Buck versus Bell in Virginia that went to the United States Supreme Court, and it resulted in an opinion which everyone remembers because Oliver Wendell Holmes said of Carrie Buck and her mother and her daughter, all of whom were supposed to be, well, it turns out it wasn't true, but were supposed to be somehow, as they said, defective. He said three generations of imbeciles are enough, and he and the court endorsed the law which required that the person who was sterilized have a hearing, be able to appeal that hearing to a court, and be able to have a lawyer if they wished.
Paul Lombardo is professor of law at the University of Georgia, author of A Century of Eugenics in America. He's with us along with Charmaine Fuller Cooper and Julie Rose. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Ivy, offering a workshop for caregivers on ways to handle challenging behaviors with relatives who have Alzheimer's. August 10th at 2 and 6 at the Ivy Adult Daycare Center. Details at theivey.com. Well, just as the swallows return to Capistrano each year, hummingbirds make a pilgrimage to Charlotte, and right now it is peak hummingbird season. So researchers and bird enthusiasts are gearing up to learn all they can about these birds as they flock to the area. Susan Campbell has been working with hummingbirds for years. She's been capturing, banding, releasing hummingbirds since 1999. And she will join us to talk about what she has learned and what she hopes to learn and why it all matters tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, drought and famine have placed 12 million people on the edge of starvation in the Horn of Africa. What's holding up aid as the humanitarian crisis deepens?
Stay tuned for that episode of the Diane Rehm Show coming up next from 10 to noon on 90.7 FM WFAE, your NPR news source for 30 years.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the eugenics program in North Carolina, which was one of many states in the country back in the early part of the 20th century, up until the 1970s here, as a matter of fact, that practiced sterilization of certain kinds of people. Charmaine Fuller Cooper is with us. She's the executive director of the North Carolina Justice for Sterilization Victims Foundation. Paul Lombardo joins us from Georgia. He's a professor of law at the University of Georgia there. And Julie Rose with WFAE News is in our studio. She's covered this reparations debate here in North Carolina rather extensively. We were talking about a person's, an individual's rights from state to state in North Carolina, Charmaine. Did people have a right to appeal? If you were somebody that they decided suddenly that you needed to be sterilized, could you appeal? Could your family appeal? Were they successful in these appeals?
Originally, a person who was ordered to be sterilized could not appeal under the 1929 legislation that the State General Assembly passed. And the North Carolina Supreme Court came back and ruled and said the law was unconstitutional for 1929 because you could not appeal and the person ordered to be sterilized did not have the right to a hearing. So that's when the Eugenics Board was created by the legislature in 1933, so that not only could the Eugenics Board review the petitions of who was being recommended for sterilization, but anyone who wanted to appeal those sterilizations, everything came back to the Eugenics Board. Unfortunately, from what we see from the state's records, once a person was ordered to be sterilized, the ball was pretty much rolling in the state's court. Nothing could really be done to stop the sterilization many times.
The Eugenics Board in North Carolina was comprised of the Commissioner of Public Welfare, the Secretary of the State Board of Health, the Chief Medical Officers of the State Hospital, and of the Institution for the Feeble-Minded, plus the Attorney General. I'm actually shocked. When I read that yesterday, I was shocked that we had something called the Institution for the Feeble-Minded. But that's how they characterize people. Who fit that description? How did they define feeble-minded?
Feeble-minded was defined very broadly within the state of North Carolina. I've never seen a clear definition of what feeble-minded could be because of its broad use. What I have seen is that the IQ limit of 70 was typically used a lot in the state's eugenics board records. If people had an IQ under 70, they were typically sterilized. And if their IQ was over 70, typically they weren't sterilized. Mm. However, there are some cases that are outliers where you have people who have IQs well above 70 and people well below 70 who were and were not sterilized.
As I was reading through this material yesterday, all of this seems rather capricious to me. Julie Rose, what have you gathered from all of this as you talk to victims, you've talked to the reparations board members and things like that? When you look back at the criteria, doesn't it seem rather odd?
I think
random.
Capricious is perhaps a good word for it, Mike. I haven't seen a lot of in-depth patient records because those are sealed for the most part, unless you have access to them through a victim. But some of the families, for example, I've spoken extensively with a family in Winston-Salem whose grandmother and great aunt were both sterilized in the late 30s. And in their records, there's a lot of reference to sort of their antisocial behaviors and inability. For example, the records talk about how One of the girls is too small to have children. They were both sterilized in their teens, 13 and 15, I think, were their ages. In one case, the little girl liked to wear coveralls, the caseworker said, and that she hangs around with a boy much younger than herself, that she has a hard time playing in a group and can't look anyone else in the eye.
Sounds autistic or Asperger's.
Potentially. Keep in mind that these two girls were part of a desperately poor family. Their father was an alcoholic. Their mother died of malnutrition. The girls were beggars, essentially, and that they had been sent off to foster homes and, you know, just lived this horrible existence. And that's actually a very common there's a living victim today named Elaine Riddick, who talks a lot about, you know, in her records it talks about her as feeble-minded and references that she was unkempt and didn't get along well with others. And she also came from a desperately poor, you know, lived with her grandmother. The social environment could lead to, could also lead, your environment at home could lead to you being categorized as feeble-minded. And as Charmaine said, it's a very broad category. And as long as they could put that label on you, feeble-minded was one of the legitimate reasons in the law.
Charmaine, you used the word elites of North Carolina being able to make these decisions or being on board with this policy. And when Julie Rose is talking, she's bringing out a picture of what I read yesterday, that a lot of people who were poor were targeted for this. Was it a socioeconomic thing? Were we trying to stamp out poverty? Is that what we were trying to do here, among other things?
The socioeconomic issue was the largest issue. A lot of people in the media, with the pictures they take and with the things they've written, have tried to point to race. But socioeconomics was the overarching issue that connected a lot of the people who were victimized by the state's eugenics board program.
Was that the case across the country, Dr. Lombardo?
I think that's true. I think that it's a combination of the language that was used in the statutes, which was, as everybody has said, extremely broad and squishy. The term feeble-mindedness came out of the 19th century and was written into a model law in 1914, which many states adopted. And it had a definition that encompassed all kinds of things. If you look at the North Carolina forms that were used for sterilization, the actual legal forms, under medical history, it says mental disease is a checklist that the board and the doctors are supposed to fill out. It says mental disease, epilepsy, convulsions, paralysis, sexual promiscuity, syphilis, tuberculosis, criminality, suicidal tendency, drug addiction, blindness, pauper, and on and on. And it then says at the bottom, as if to be a hint, the Eugenics Board has jurisdiction only in case of mental disease, feeble-mindedness, or epilepsy. And my guess is, as in most states, people filling out the forms always made sure to check feeble-mindedness, because that was the key to getting somebody sterilized.
Mm-hmm. And as an example, Mike, I've got a stack here of case summaries that the Eugenics Board would have reviewed. They would typically get a kind of a quick paragraph that says, you know, for example, who had recommended, who had instituted this sterilization, the county where the resident lived. This is a single woman, age, how many kids she had, what her IQ level was. And in every single one of these, feeble-minded is the diagnosis. I mean, it was clearly a very kind of wide-ranging and perhaps convenient. I mean, the vast majority of sterilizations that were approved by the Eugenics Board in North Carolina were feeble-minded was the justification.
I want to bring somebody new into this conversation. Leela Dunstan is a victim of this. She was sterilized as a child and is now part of this reparations conversation that's going on statewide. And she is sitting next to Charmaine Fuller Cooper in our studio at WUNC in Durham. Thank you for being here, Leela.
Thank you.
How old were you when you were sterilized by the state?
13 years old.
And why? What reason did they give you?
I don't know.
You don't know? They didn't tell you?
No.
Did they tell your parents? Did your parents have a say-so in this?
They told my mother she had to do it.
You sound very emotional about this even today, correct?
Yes.
This is difficult to talk about.
It is.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions, because obviously when you're sterilized at the age of 13, you can't have children anymore. obviously this has impacted your life in a deep, deep way.
Yes.
When they came to you and decided to proceed with this, did you know what was going to happen to you? Did they say it was they were taking your appendix out, as I've been told they have in some cases? The woman didn't know what was happening to them. And this happens to boys, too.
I didn't know.
You didn't?
I didn't know. Really, I didn't know.
What was your family life like at the time you were 13 that led to this? What reasons could they possibly have had for targeting you?
Well, they say I couldn't function in the neighborhood. I didn't get along with people around the neighborhood, and all of us played together, all of the kids played together and everything. We never didn't get along.
How did they even know who you were? You're a 13-year-old girl. Where were you living at the time?
Wilmington, North Carolina.
Okay, you're a 13-year-old in Wilmington. There's a significant population at the time, one would believe, in Wilmington. How would you even come to their attention?
What happened, I had a child at the age of 13.
Mm-hmm.
My son is 50 years old almost,
mm-hmm.
and I'm 63.
So because you had a child at the age of 13, you were considered, I guess, promiscuous, to use
yes.
their term? And they wanted to put a stop to that?
Yes.
Were you on welfare? Was your family on welfare?
Well, my mother, she was getting welfare. Mm-hmm. They was giving her a little check. But I never was on welfare. I didn't want nothing. They told me that they would take care of me for the rest of my life. But they never did. They ain't did nothing for me.
Hmm.
I got out there and worked at hospitals and hotels and...
So obviously you weren't feeble-minded, or feeble of body. You were able to work. Did
yes.
a social worker who was maybe working with your parents witness this? And
she was just working with my mother.
Did she do it?
Never. Yeah.
She turned you in, essentially. She essentially recommended you, he or
yes.
she.
Yes.
A lot of victims have spent years trying to cope with this for obvious reasons, and many of them have been described as having justifiable simmering anger. Are you angry about this? Are you bitter about this? Are you sad how would you describe your feelings about what happened to you?
Right now, I'm bitter about it because I can't get no justification out of it. And I got to have a justification.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know something. Why they did this to me. I need a closure. I can't get no closure.
Mm-hmm.
Before I can get a closure to this, I feel better.
And obviously you felt like this for a long time, it would seem to me. This movement now to get reparations for the victims of this practice of eugenics is a relatively recent movement. Before that, did you have anybody to talk to about this? Any recourse? Did you see anybody about was there anybody to see to talk to about this prior to that?
No. No, it wasn't.
Can money...
I talked to my husband.
Mm-hmm.
I got married to a man, and he's been right by my side.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to him mostly.
Can money...
And now I talk to my son.
Okay.
Now, about it.
Will money fix what was done to you in terms of... Will that bring closure to you? Will some kind of monetary compensation help you?
Yes. Some kind of monetary payment will satisfy me to bring a closure.
Mm-hmm.
But $20,000, that ain't enough.
Is that what they're recommending? Is that what they recommended in the past? $20,000?
Yeah.
What is enough?
if they gave me 60,000 to 70,000, that'll be enough for me. I can go ahead on and close it.
Charmaine, how many victims still remain who are still alive in North Carolina?
North Carolina State Center for Health Statistics estimates that roughly 2,944 people are still living, so roughly 3,000 people. The statistician, Don Aiken, who compiled that estimate for us, is actually looking at the fact that a lot of things we just don't know about the population that was targeted for these sterilizations. And based on lifestyle, nutrition needs, access to health care, socioeconomic needs, that the number may more realistically be between 1,500 and 2,000 people who could be living.
Leela Dunstan, have you spoken with other people that this was done to?
Number one young lady, she came to the meeting, and I talked to her and her son, and that's about the only part.
Is her story similar to yours in terms of how this has impacted her life and the way she feels about what has happened to her?
Yes.
And did you have a chance to talk to her about what she feels would bring closure to her?
I don't know. She want to get compensated.
Mm-hmm. The $20,000 figure that Leela Dunstan mentioned a moment ago, Charmaine, I believe came from a legislative committee that recommended that sum, because Governor Easley issued an official state apology in 2002, and then this legislative committee recommended $20,000 per victim in 2008. Was any of that money ever paid to anybody?
Mike, no money has ever been distributed to any victim. No tangible services have ever been given to any victims.
Why not?
That's been a huge question. There's been a lot of back and forth with the state legislature, and when Governor Beverly Perdue took office, she had huge concerns about the justice that had been denied for victims. So her first effort as governor was to create the North Carolina Justice for Sterilization Victims Foundation to find out how many victims are still living, and so that victims would have a comfortable place to contact, to self-identify, and to find out if they had a name match with the Eugenics Board records.
We're going to talk about this reparation process here in the next segment, but Dr. Lombardo, I'm curious what's happening in other states. Are other states having to deal with reparations? Have they dealt with it? Have they paid money to the victims? What's the story there?
No, Mike, actually the apology movement, which really began with an apology in Virginia in 2002, was followed by North Carolina, South Carolina, Oregon, in California, and then eventually Indiana and Georgia. And all those states, even though legislatures and governors issued apologies, nobody paid a nickel. This is in contrast to what happened in other countries. Canada, for example, had a series of lawsuits in the late 1990s in Alberta and British Columbia. The Alberta case ended up in about $100 million being paid to the survivors there, some 500 people. And then the case in British Columbia, there were nine women who got about $50,000 apiece. People overseas in countries like Germany and also some Scandinavian countries many, many years ago paid some token sums to his reparation as well.
So this was a worldwide phenomenon, which I guess was discredited by the Nazi movement because they were targeting Jews and others for extermination and did so successfully. They didn't just sterilize them, they exterminated them, and that's what I guess helped to discredit this whole movement around the world. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this on the other side with Charmaine Fuller Cooper, Paul Lombardo, Julie Rose, and Leela Dunstan. Stay with us, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and James McElroy and Deal, Counsel for the Life of a Business, practical solutions to everyday and unforeseen problems, serving the Charlotte area over 50 years. Details at jmdlaw.com. Drought and famine have placed 12 million people on the edge of starvation in the Horn of Africa. What's holding up aid as the humanitarian crisis deepens? That's the topic of the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-WFAE. 800-603-WFAE. And online, you can do it at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, and that includes Facebook and Twitter as well. Stay with us. We're coming right back.
Hi, I'm Mark Rumsey. With All Things Considered, you get to know the people making the decisions that shape your world, as well as the artists and entertainers who enlighten it. From Washington, D.C. to Wall Street to your street, you'll always find something new to think about on All Things Considered. News you can trust, weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the practice of eugenics and now the movement to get reparations for the folks in North Carolina, at least, who were victims of this practice from the 1930s to the 1970s. Charmaine Fuller Cooper is with us. She's the executive director of the North Carolina Justice for Sterilization Victims Foundation. She's at WUNC in Durham, as is Leela Dunstan, who is a sterilization victim. Paul Lombardo is a professor of law at the University of Georgia and author of A Century of Eugenics in America. And Julie Rose is a reporter here at WFAE who's been covering these conversations about reparations rather extensively. Leela, did your parents protest this at all? Were you aware of them having any problem with this or trying to stop this happening to you at any time?
Well, my aunt, God bless the day, she told my mother, she said, don't you let them people do that to her, because she won't never have no more kids. And I don't know, I guess because she was feeble-minded, they say feeble-minded. Mm-hmm. But my mama had good sense, because she used to go to church every Sunday morning. And she loved Jesus, and she went to, I don't know what possessed her. Mm-hmm. I guess money. And then they wanted to put me in the Old Bury School. I ran away from there.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be there.
You said money. Was the welfare check that she was depending on dependent upon her following through on this procedure?
Yeah. Yeah.
Julie, you reported that the North Carolina Eugenics Board was created in 1933 and operated for decades with little public scrutiny. Is that because, by and large, the public agreed with what was going on here because it was considered to be state-of-the-art scientific thought, or because they were operating behind a curtain? That was just the common practice back then.
Well, from what I have been able to understand, it's not as though the eugenics board was hiding what it was doing. I mean, if people had asked, they would have proudly acknowledged this is how many sterilizations. I mean, they were doing biennial reports, you know, talking about the numbers, which are now open for us to access. I think a lot of it has to do with sort of what the thinking was at the time. And you had the pressure of these welfare rolls, especially after World War II, that were growing. And, you know, the cost, as Dr. Lombardo said, to care for these individuals. And then you had also this eugenics board, which you had the Human Betterment League right here, which had editorials in the newspaper and was very well funded. And so North Carolina was very unique in that after World War II, that's when things really got going. The majority of the sterilizations in this state took place after World War II, as a contrast to other states. And that's also why we have more living victims than most states who did this.
Because we continued with the process, actually became more aggressive with the process, even as other states were stopping the process.
Right. And there are, I mean, there were some of the victims who are coming forward today. Elaine Riddick, for example, is one that's been out in the news quite a bit. I mean, she was sterilized in 1968. So she's young. I mean, she's in her 50s today.
Here in Mecklenburg County, between 1946, post-World War II, and 1968, 465 people in Mecklenburg County were sterilized, often against their will, you said in one of your stories. Wouldn't it have always been against their will? Would anybody do this to themselves voluntarily, really?
Well, consent was typically given in these records that were presented to the Eugenics Board. But consent I think coercion is probably more likely in a lot of these cases. I mean, you just heard Leela talking about how, you know, she was, her mother was
right.
basically threatened with losing her welfare. I mean, that was common. North Carolina was also unique in that the state allowed social workers to make recommendations. But there were instances. I mean, you do see in the records instances where apparently there were women who didn't have access to other kinds of birth control. This was before 1960 when the pill became widely available, mm-hmm. and sterilization was potentially an option. That there are instances in the records I have read where a couple with, you know, who's struggling to make ends meet and they want to be able to stop having children. They've got 5 or 6 or 7 already. There is some evidence that there were women and men who used the eugenics laws to get sterilization because they wanted it. But that would be a very, very small percentage.
Julie mentioned a second ago that one of the reasons that post-World War II we ramped it up here in North Carolina was because the welfare rolls were growing after World War II. Put that in some sort of context throughout the country, Dr. Lombardo. Other states cut back. We ramped it up. How unusual? Obviously, it was very unusual. Why did we do that and other states didn't do it?
There was a fair amount of pressure in the 60s, particularly the mid-60s, and the reintroduction of what one author called punitive sterilization proposals, which is people have already described, were focused on anybody who was on welfare, in particular anybody who had more than one child. And so the feeling in some states was that these old laws, even if they'd been criticized as being not scientific anymore, could still be used as a way of, again, cutting down on the welfare rolls. So the economic motive came up very strongly, and many politicians supported this whole idea. It is the case that North Carolina was more aggressive than most states, and at a very late date. There are very few states that were really going after people quite the way that North Carolina was in the 60s and even the 70s.
Something very disturbing in one of the reports that you filed here for WFAE, Julie, you reported that often sterilizations happened at the recommendation of a social worker, which we've talked about, but that anyone could suggest a person be sterilized, that the eugenics board often used, quote, rudimentary IQ tests and gossip from neighbors to justify sterilization of young girls from poor families who hung around with the wrong crowd or didn't do well in school. Now, that sounds like something you would hear about in a fascist or communist state and not in the United States. How could we have justified that? Gossip.
Yeah, and this is something Charmaine and I have actually spoken about. So Charmaine, feel free to jump in here. I mean, there clearly was during this period when suddenly it wasn't just individuals who were in state-run institutions like the boys and girls schools, for children who were either mentally retarded or who had behavioral problems, and it wasn't just when the sterilizations were suddenly now open to basically anyone that a social worker could make the recommendation. I mean, there's a lot of sort of neighborhood. I mean, think about what happens in a neighborhood when you know the girl on the corner, she's 13, she's pregnant, you see her hanging out with the wrong kids, and it's in a neighborhood where the social worker comes frequently, and you do see in these case files, you know, kind of hearsay and word of mouth that in a lot of these instances, it's very possible that, like you were saying, how did they find out about Leela? Well, you know, it's potentially true that her neighbors told the social worker. I mean, it was definitely kind of a social phenomenon, I think.
And in Leela's case, Charmaine, this happened in the 1960s. I remember being in school talking about how the Nazis and the secret police would get information from everybody, that everybody told on everybody, and that same thing happened in the communist states. And this was things that happened in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s. And here it is, the 60s, and we're still doing this?
Yeah, and unfortunately, just to flash back a little bit to the 1930s, we have to remember that many of the families that were affected by the Great Depression, not only in North Carolina, but nationwide, never recovered. We have to look at the fact that from the 1930s to the 1970s, that many technologies families were getting for the first time, such as indoor plumbing, running water, electricity, we have to remember that some of these young ladies would go to the rural country store to get groceries for their families and walk back to the house. And if they had walked to that store too late at night, that a neighbor could say, that young lady is promiscuous, because in North Carolina, being a very rural area, those little country stores during the day might turn into a juke joint at night, and you would have all sorts of inflammatory gossip that wasn't true. With one of the patient files that we've looked at the foundation, we saw where, for in one instance with a social worker, where she went to a very rural area, and in her notes, she wrote that this family is very unkempt. They're always dirty when I go to see them. They're not supervising the children. The children are just running around. And when you look at the file, you start to notice that this family were either sharecroppers or farmers, that every time the social worker would drive up, she was driving up to a very rural area. The adults were in the field tending to their crops, and if they didn't tend a certain amount of crops within a certain amount of time during that day, they wouldn't get money to pay their bills or to make sure there was food on the table. And the children were in the neighboring yard playing while the adults are tending to the crops. So there was really a social disconnect going on, not only in North Carolina, but in America at that time, where you had people who were making huge judgments on other people's lives and lifestyles. And also in that same historical context of noticing the technological advances that we were getting in America, from indoor plumbing to electricity, we also must look at the fact that we had the voting rights movement going on during the 50s and 60s. We had the civil rights movement going on during the 50s and 60s. We had the women's rights movement going on during these times. And we have received calls from individuals who, you know, their parents were not comfortable with interracial dating during these periods as well. So there have been young ladies who have told us that, you know, their fathers recommended that they be sterilized as well.
Wow, Julie.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I also just wanted to introduce another piece of this that is disturbing. When you talk about, Charmaine mentioned the consent, you know, that a father might have given consent. There are instances, quite a few in the records, where an abusive husband, for example, would be giving consent for his wife to be sterilized. But even more troubling, that young girls, very young girls, who were apparently the object of incest, and, you know, the doctor would do an exam and find that she had been sexually active at the age of 12 or 10 or something like that, that perhaps she had had a child, and that it hadn't necessarily been publicly acknowledged, but that the father or the brother was the father of, you know, of this child. And then you look to see who has consented to the sterilization, and it would be the father who is perpetrating this incest, and, you know, and basically trying to, you know, the thinking was, let's make sure we don't have these products of incest, but essentially signing a blank check for these abusive fathers. So,
and no future proof of the incest as a result. Let me take a phone call here from Nicole in Charlotte. Nicole, you're on WFAU. Welcome. You there, Nicole? I guess Nicole's not there. Let's go to Bill in Concord. Welcome.
Hello. I heard a little bit earlier Mike say something to the effect that the Nazis had the intention of exterminating people, and perhaps North Carolina did not. I was a young man, newly married in the very early 70s, and I often had lunch with my in-laws at Myers Park Country Club and some of the city leaders at the time. My comment, and then I have a question, my comment is, have no doubt that the objective of the some of the folks at perhaps Myers Park Presbyterian Church, who then lunched on Sunday at Myers Park Country Club, was extermination. This had to do with coloreds and retards. Have no doubt about that. And that those people, with those attitudes, are still alive and still going to the country club and still going to those churches. So it hasn't gone away. That's my comment. My question is this: how in the world can North Carolina, can the state of North Carolina, be proud of trying to take 6 months to determine if the payoff, and that's what this is, a payoff, should be between $20,000 and $50,000? What would either of you pay not to be sterilized, or not to have your children, especially your quote retarded children, sterilized? The fact that North Carolina is laughing all the way to the bank, I think, is absolutely reprehensible. That's a question, and I'll take the comment off the air.
Okay, I'm not sure that. Well, we'll go ahead. Who wants to take a stab at what I thought was a question in there someplace? Charmaine.
Well, you know, Mike, I agree. It is a slap in the face for many victims that this process has gone on for too long. For Ms. Riddick and Ms. Ramirez, who were publicly known victims who were the first to sue the state in the 1970s after they were wrongfully sterilized and lost their lawsuit, they've been battling this since this sterilization happened. They knew they were sterilized.
So very quickly, because we're running out of time, Charmaine, very quickly, what are you hoping that will happen? How would this be handled? How many people would get compensation? Would it only be the victims who were sterilized, or would it be the families of the victims? Would it be only the victims who are still alive? Would it be only the victims who come forward? How would it work?
The victims are asking that each of the living victims be compensated, but we also have other descendants and living victims who are also asking for the family members to be compensated as well. The governor established the Eugenics Compensation Task Force in March of this year, and that task force has gone back and forth not only on what would be a respectful amount, knowing that no amount of compensation can repay a person for what's been done to them and taken away from them, but also looking at who would be able to qualify. Right now, the consensus is that victims would need to self-identify because of privacy issues related to some victims who've contacted our offices and said that their husbands have never known that they've been sterilized, or they don't want to open up the fact that their children may find out that the person they thought was their father is actually not their father.
And
so
Charmaine,
there are some privacy issues.
And Charmaine, in this process, all this publicity over the last year, how many people have actually come forward and self-identified?
I don't have the numbers directly in front of me. We've had anywhere from 100 to 200 people come forward with questions and inquiries related to whether they're a victim. Of that number, about 3 to 4 dozen have been verified as victims out of that new number.
In 10 seconds or less, how much is enough? And how much can we afford?
I don't think any amount is enough. But that's going to be an issue for the legislature to decide.
Okay, and Paul Lombardo,
that decision comes swiftly.
If we decide to give compensation, does this open the door to other states? Are other states worried about this very quickly?
Well, it seems to me that other states ought to be thinking about it already, although none have come forward.
Paul Lombardo, professor of law at the University of Georgia, author of A Century of Eugenics in America, Charmaine Fuller Cooper with the North Carolina Justice for Sterilization Victims Foundation, Julie Rose with WFAE, and Leela Dunstan, a sterilization victim. Thank you all for being here.